Okay, I think today we are ready to kick off the session. Our speaker will explain how people working to protect and restore water bodies can use the Clean Water Act to assist them in their efforts. The webcast will focus on water quality standards and how they relate to several Clean Water Act programs. Our speaker is Gail Killam, who directs the Clean Water Act program at River Network. In her position at River Network, Gail trains and supports citizens across the country in their efforts to better implement the Clean Water Act. Gail created an online course on the Clean Water Act and recently authored the second edition of River Network's document, The Clean Water Act Owner's Manual. We have an exciting presentation today, so let's get started. I'll now turn the microphone over to Gail Killam.
Thanks, Ron. Can you hear me?
You sound good, Gail.
Okay. Wanted to make sure I do this right. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining in today. I just wanted to say a few things about River Networks. Many of you may not know who we are. We are, in fact, a support organization for groups working to protect freshwater resources across the country. In addition to my program, the Clean Water Act program, we also work with citizens on monitoring, design and monitoring programs, design and implementation of surveys that connect public health concerns with environmental problems, and a lot of organizational development support and assistance as well. We work with groups individually, give trainings, and help others to become trainers. Our biggest training event every year is our annual River Rally, which some of you may have heard about, and is happening May 5th through 9th in New Hampshire this year, and next year we'll be on the Columbia River in Stevenson, Washington. Many more resources are available. You can see the list that was attached or in some way connected to where you logged in for the webcast. On additional resources, we also have our website, www.rivernetwork.org. You can see more about us. On the additional resources list, you can see where you can get a copy of the Clean Water Act Owner's Manual, find out more about the online Clean Water Act course, and our state database, searchable online on Clean Water Act information. So you can see that also on my last slide. I wanted to start with a little bit of a disclaimer. This is not my typical format. I really do prefer audience interaction, and this will be interesting and I hope useful for all of you. I'm in Portland, Oregon as we speak, and so I'm knowing that in the West people are still probably needing a lot of coffee, and in the East it's after lunch, so folks may be heading into their food coma, and in the middle of the country, in Mountain Central time, you probably don't have too many excuses. But I'm going to see how this goes. I'll try to keep your attention for the next couple hours. As I go along, I may intentionally pass over a slide here and there just in the interest of time. The slides are all included for content purposes. So if I skip over it, I'll let you know I'm doing that. And I've been given strict orders to let you know what slide I'm on, so I'm hoping that I'll continue to remember that. So with that, I'm going to get started now. I'm going to slide two, please. The Clean Water Act really was passed as a broad mandate with a lot of bipartisan support, and you can see these quotes, very powerful quotes that relate back to that time of passage. Slide three, we see that there was a long path to get to where we got to in 1972 when the Act was passed. Many previous versions of what we now know as the Clean Water Act led up to the 1972 version. Slide four, we really get to some of the sweeping changes that were instituted in 1972. And most importantly, what I want to focus on today is the fact that this 72 change really did give an incredible amount of power to citizens through public involvement requirements and through citizen suits that were allowed. The public involvement part is a critical piece that we'll talk about throughout every part of the course that we'll talk about today. Slide five, there have been subsequent amendments to the Clean Water Act, which many of you probably know about, though no whole reauthorization. Many of these changes include details about our stormwater program that a lot of you may be involved with, and adding authority for tribes to take over the program in their jurisdictions. But getting to slide six is really where we're going to start our training today. The Clean Water Act, I like to start with the Clean Water Act main goal or objective as it's stated in the front page of the Act, which is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. When this Act was passed in 72, there was really this broader sense of the integrity of the waters in the chemical, physical, and biological components to it, not just a clean stream, if you will, more of a healthy ecosystem. And then the fact that it addressed restoring and maintaining meant that we're not just going to go out and try to fix things and allow other things to worsen as we do so. We're going to really maintain and hold on to the quality that we do have. So looking at what the Congress set to achieve that objective, we talked about essentially national goals. They set a set of interim national goals, two of which were to eliminate the discharge of pollutants to surface waters, and also that all waters would at one day be fishable and swimmable wherever that's attainable. I wonder if folks know what was meant at this shorthand of fishable and swimmable that we often use, and whether or not it's just about being able to throw a line in the water and catch fish, or is it just about swimming? If you go to slide 7, you'll see that, in fact, the added text there shows that the language from the Act talked more broadly about water quality, which provides for the protection and propagation of fish, shellfish, and wildlife, and provides for recreation in and on the water. So it's much more than just being able to throw in a line and catch some fish. The other point I'd make here is that there were dates associated with these national goals, eliminating the discharge of pollutants by 1985 and reaching these fishable swimmable goals by 1983. Not to be discouraged, even though we've passed those dates by some degree, we still are working our way towards them. But it's interesting to note when the goals were set and how they were set. Moving to slide 8, I've set up the beginning of a diagram that we'll look at a few times in the next couple hours. Starting with the goals, as we were just talking about, looking to how they reach out, how they lead into the water quality standards that we'll be talking about in the next couple hours, and also into the discharge permits. If some of you may know it for its acronym, the NPDES program, and how those two programs came out of the goals and, in fact, are related to one another. The water quality standards do, in fact, feed into the discharge permit program in significant ways. Slide 9 shows a little bit of a preview about other things that we'll touch on at the very end, towards the end of the webcast, when we're talking about how the water quality standards are applied in so many, in fact, all of the Clean Water Act tools. And that's mostly why we're focusing on the water quality standards today, because without the fundamental understanding of those standards, your involvement in the Clean Water Act tools is not as powerful as it could be. So it's important to start there. There's a lot of interaction with these tools. We can create a circle. You can have it more linearly. We'll talk more about this diagram after we've covered some more ground. And keep in mind, please, that the Clean Water Act Owner's Manual, our online course, and the resources provided from EPA all add significant amounts of detail if you want to dive into any of the topics that we'll touch on briefly today. As much as we do our best, the 2 hours is a short amount of time to cover a lot of legwork, a lot of ground here. On slide 10, it's important for me to have us all think about what brings us to the Clean Water Act. Why are you listening in today? What drew you to this webcast, this topic? Whether it's the fact that you have drinking water protection concerns in your watershed, you've got endangered and threatened species, perhaps there's a proposed project in your watershed, and you're concerned about that and thinking that there may be some tools of the Clean Water Act can help you to have it happen in the most sustainable ways. We all come to the Clean Water Act tools for different reasons, and therefore we're all looking for something different out of it. And so we're going to keep that in mind as we go forward in the next couple hours as well. Slide 11 is a little bit of an overview of what we'll try to cover. The water quality standards have three components, and we'll touch on each one of those, the designated uses, water quality criteria, and the anti-degradation policy. And we'll then talk about how, in brief ways, how they apply to discharge permits, the MPDES program, threatened and impaired waters list that many of you may have heard of as a 303D list, watershed restoration plans, or otherwise known as total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, state water quality certification, the 401 program. These numbers are all the connections to the sections of the Clean Water Act, by the way, and the non-point source control program, the 319 program. So moving right along to getting started on our standards discussion here, on slide 12, the three components of the water quality standards, designated uses, water quality criteria, anti-degradation policy. They're all critical pieces to what the states and tribes have to put together when they're developing their water quality standards. If you go to slide 13, you'll see the actual federal regulations that talk about what water quality standards need to be. They need to define the water quality goals of a water body or a portion thereof by designating the uses to be made of the water and by setting criteria necessary. I'd like to point out I'm going to be using a lot of references to the federal regulations as well as a few to the Clean Water Act itself. The reference there is from what is called the Code of Federal Regulations, Chapter 40, Section 131.2. It's important to be able to maneuver around these regulations and state regulations as well. We'll look at a lot of state examples. Not to be intimidated by them. They're usually fairly readable. And the Code of Federal Regulations in particular is available, found pretty easily online if you Google the Code of Federal Regulations. I've noticed, and any time I've done it, that it comes up quite easily. Another piece of information to point out is that the Clean Water Act that we talk about is a statute that was passed by Congress in 72. The regulations are then, in the case of any law or act, the agency, in this case the U.S. EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, was required to develop regulations that would further explain how the Clean Water Act was going to be implemented. And that's what these regulations are that we'll refer to, the Clean Water Act regulations. You may know a little bit about guidance documents that further are refined by agencies. They come up with a little bit more detail about how something is implemented, but it's always important to go back to the regulations and the statute to really see what the legal requirements are. So the states, and this is as defined, 50 states, District of Columbia are U.S. territories and Indian tribes that EPA determines to be eligible for purpose of the Water Quality Standards Program are all responsible for reviewing, establishing, and revising water quality standards. And in fact, they may develop standards that are more stringent than required by the federal regulations. So moving to slide 14, we're going to start in with the first component of water quality standards, the designated uses. They drive the standards, and I think sometimes folks overlook the importance of the uses and how everything really goes back to them. So moving on to slide 15, I'd like you to just take a minute and think about the uses that occur in the waters near you. If you feel like it, this is my interaction time, but obviously I can't do this with you. You can jot some down, thinking about these uses. What do you see going on in the waters? In what ways do you or your family or your neighbors use the waters? What have you seen going on in and around these waters? And what uses are dependent on the waters? It's the states and tribes' responsibility to designate the uses for our waters, and we can all look to see what our state or tribe has officially designated by finding and examining the state water quality standards. These water quality standards for each state and tribe can be found on your additional resources list. There's the second EPA reference, which is to the EPA Water Quality Standards homepage. And also River Network has a reference site, the online searchable state database, where you can also get the state water quality standards from either place. So now we're going to look at some examples, assuming that you've written down some or thought of some that you know of in your area. moving to slide 16, we're first going to look at an example from Pennsylvania. And as I mentioned, it's important to become comfortable with state and federal regulations, and it's not too hard usually to figure them out. And here we have a list of the statewide water uses in Pennsylvania. You'll see the main categories, aquatic life, water supply, recreation, and then the subcategories below them. If you are looking at this list, you might wonder why there are symbols next to them. Those symbols are used typically in most states in basin tables to identify which uses are specifically designated for which water body segment. So you'll have a state general setup like this, and then it will go on to have a later table of uses in specific basins. So that's fairly typical, though not consistent across all states. If you go to slide 17, we have another example from Alabama, and you'll see some consistency or certainly similarities in the ways that the states have chosen to designate their state list of uses. For example, public water supply in Alabama was potable water supply in Pennsylvania, where you have separations for boating, fishing, water contact sports in Pennsylvania. You have swimming and other whole body water contact sports all put together in Alabama. So you'll see different things as you look at your states and maybe multiple states, different examples. And that's important to note and to think about how it best represents what's going on in your waters. Slide 18 is still another example from Tennessee. The broad categories, again, mostly are here with only a couple subcategories under the fish and aquatic life use here. And again, they've got the symbols that are then used in place in the basin-specific lists. Going to slide 19, you can actually see an example of the basin-specific uses in Tennessee for the Hatchie River. You'll see the Hatchie River has been designated for 6 of the 9 uses, all except the specific trout and specific trout subcategories. And take a look and see what the tributaries have been designated for. If you can tell in there what, referring back to the reference list on the previous slide, what those different symbols mean, what the different letters mean and are representing. So you can kind of see that it looks like for all the different creeks in Hatchie River, leading to Hatchie River, that you've got fish and aquatic life, recreation, livestock watering and wildlife, and irrigation as designated uses in those waters. And they haven't, as within the Hatchie main stem, you don't also have the domestic or industrial water supply listed. So that's an example of what you might see in a basin list and how these waters are represented. And I wonder if you think that these basin lists include every water body. I mean, the kind of detail that's here, it looks like you might be seeing hundreds of pages of basin-specific uses listed in many states, and that is the case. they are quite long, but in fact, in most states cannot really list every single water body. And if you go to slide 20, you can see what Tennessee has done, where they have listed a separate category for all other surface waters, named and unnamed, in the Hatchie Basin, and have listed the specific uses, the same as the tributaries, as a matter of fact, that will be designated for those waters. There is, in fact, often a catch-all set of uses, either stated up front in the water quality standards or at the beginning of the basin tables, or in Tennessee's case, it's for each basin. So keep in mind and find the ways that your jurisdiction has decided to capture all of the water bodies that aren't going to be specifically listed in the basin tables. So now, going to slide 21, we have a little bit of a quiz, and it's not on what you've seen so far, and it's not anything I'm going to ask you to call out, and I can't hear any of you anyway, so you can stop yelling into your phones. we're just going to give you a minute to look at these questions, and the quizzes are intended for your benefit, to identify important pieces of information that is worth, they're worth knowing, in the hopes that as we go forward through the information in the course, that you'll retain the information, and that, time permitting, we'll go back to the quizzes toward the end. So take a minute or two and think about or jot down the answers to these questions if you know them, and hopefully we'll get a chance to come back to them. But they're for your benefit. Okay, enough time for the quiz. We're going to go on to slide 22 and some information about designated uses, this first component of every state and tribe's water quality standards. First of all, designated uses must be assigned to every water body. And as we have seen, they are generally assigned to segments. Now, this means that the state or tribe also has the responsibility of deciding what the segments are in your watershed and in all of your state's water bodies. And that's an important thing to note, whether or not those segments have in fact been set up in the right way. Are the different tributaries in the way it was broken up in the Hatchie River, for example, in Tennessee, the appropriate breakdowns to put into the standards? And if they aren't all separated out, there really must be a catch-all list of uses for the rest of the waters that are not specifically listed. The designated uses also must include aquatic life, wildlife, and recreation. Why do you think that is? Does it make sense that those are specifically called out as special categories? And if you think back to the basic Clean Water Act goal of fishable, swimmable, or in fact the water quality which provides for the protection and propagation of fish, shellfish, and wildlife and provides for recreation in and on the water, that's where that comes from. So the requirement that those basic goals are set for all water bodies is a fundamental part of this act, and we'll get back to that a little later. The challenges and realities of that requirement. The designated uses must be set to protect downstream waters. In fact, stated directly in the federal regulations, it says, in designating uses of a water body and the appropriate criteria for those uses, the state shall take into consideration the water quality standards of downstream waters and shall ensure that its water quality standards provide for the attainment and maintenance of the water quality standards of downstream waters. So there's an explicit attention to what's going on downstream and what we're designating and what the impact will be. And then also the designated uses must protect all existing uses. And this is an important term, an important concept, defined in the regulations as uses actually attained on or after November 28, 1975. That date is magical because it's when the Clean Water Act regulations were passed, after the 72 Act was passed. And it also includes, existing uses also include the uses that water quality supports but may not be occurring. And that is listed in the EPA Water Quality Standards Handbook as another part of the existing uses piece. So we're going to come back to existing uses a few times. It's an important concept there. On to slide 23, we have a set of typical designated uses, which we actually just saw in our state examples. They're stated in different ways. As we saw, aquatic life can sometimes be cold water fishery. Agriculture can sometimes be livestock watering. The less typical categories, we did see a couple of them. In Pennsylvania, there was something that referred to aesthetics. And in Alabama, there was a shellfish harvesting, which is kind of associated with, may be associated with aquaculture, may not. But there are typical ones, and those are slightly less typical, and we see them in specific regions and specific ways, times that the states have required or decided that was an appropriate use. I'm wondering whether or not you all came up with uses that you know of in your waters that we haven't seen in these examples or back in the state examples a few slides back, whether a broader category or subcategory. The kind of input that you could offer to say that certain uses are not covered in your state water quality standards is very important to the state agencies. They don't know every water body and what's going on in every water body. They certainly haven't ground truth to everyone. So it's an important role we can play, and the states are supposed to be soliciting this information on a 3-year basis in the triennial review. We'll discuss that in a little bit. On slide 24, the designated uses actually have their own definition in the federal regulations. Those uses specified in water quality standards for each water body or segment, whether or not they're being attained, they really are specified as goals. They don't have to be currently attained, but they have to be supposed to be attainable. And that gets into our issue on slide 25 about whether or not a designated use can be weakened or removed. And so once the uses are put in place, the designated uses are really set as goals and, as I said, the fundamental part of the other tools. And a state cannot remove or weaken a use if it is in fact existing, as we talked about, as I mentioned a couple slides back, or if it is attainable. And the concept of attainable is important as to how it's set up in the regulations. It says at a minimum a use can be attained by implementing permits, and in particular the industry-wide technology-based permits for discharge, or cost-effective and reasonable practices for non-point source control. So that's the minimum level, and in fact there needs to be a process if there is a proposal for removing or weakening a designated use that I'll mention in a minute. It's important to note that the regulations implementing the Clean Water Act effectively establish a rebuttable presumption that Clean Water Act basic uses, the fishable and swimmable part, are attainable. So it's really, the onus is on those who wish to change them to say why they aren't. So if something is proposed, going to slide 26, a use attainability analysis needs to be performed. And this is defined as a scientific assessment of the factors that are affecting the attainability of the use, the attainment of the use, that is. And it's required, as we was just mentioned in the previous slide, when the designated use is proposed for weakening or removal, or if in fact the current designated uses don't include the basic Clean Water Act uses that we've been talking about. So there's two reasons why use attainability analysis would be required, and in fact this is important because there's a lot of attention on use attainability analyses these days out at the state level for various reasons where states or entities coming to the states are wishing to remove or revise uses that they feel are not appropriate for the water body and have some effect on the activities that can be going on in the waters. So keeping in mind that the regulations establish this rebuttable presumption that fishable, swimmable uses are attainable, and that in the use attainability analysis process, the burden of proof is really on the entity proposing the weakening or removal. So keeping those in mind. Now, when would this kind of thing happen? If we go to slide 27, I'm just going to, in the interest of time, mention one of these examples, and perhaps we can come back to them. But in Kentucky a number of years ago, there were 25 cold water streams that were proposed for downgrading to a warm water designation. And a group that we have worked with for years in Kentucky, the Kentucky Waterways Alliance, in fact got a number of their members, fishermen in particular, who represented 14 of those 25 cold water streams to come to the public hearing on this proposal and say that they in fact had significant cold water characteristics, and Kentucky really focuses on the trout species, so they could talk about the trout species in these waters. That representation by the public prevented those 14 segments from being downgraded, and then the Kentucky Waterways Alliance folks pushed for use attainability analyses that hadn't been done for the remaining 11. In the end, only 9 were approved as for downgrading, and in fact one of the originally proposed streams for downgrading has since been protected as a reference stream for cold water aquatic habitat. So that was an important change in evaluation of the quality of that water. And this is to point out that the role that the citizens can play simply in explaining what they know about their water bodies can really make a difference in these procedures and finding out where the waters are designated or perhaps proposed for changes. Slide 28 talks a little bit more about what you could do to protect your, to understand and protect your designated uses. Understanding, going out and documenting the uses in the water body and sharing what you see with the water quality agency. Reviewing what's already in your standards, your state standards, and advocating for the protection of all uses and whether or not the broader categories fully cover the smaller uses you might know about. Examining the segments, and are they appropriate? Do they simply start and end at one bridge or an interstate rather than a bend in the river or a confluence? Thinking about really how the segments are set up and whether they make sense in separate designation of uses. And most importantly, requesting changes where they seem to be needed can happen in at least two different ways. There's a triennial review process that I'll get to in 1 second, and that is supposed to be that is intended for public review of water quality standards. There's also, in between the triennial review processes, there should be a state process for petitioning for changes to the state agency. So looking into that when it's needed. On slide 29, 30, and 31, there's a little bit of explanation about the triennial review. It's required of each state on a regular basis, in fact, at least once every three years, to be looking at the water quality standards to see if they're appropriate, in particular, making sure that some of the basic Clean Water Act uses are protected, and whether or not it can be the public's best chance to comment on the adequacy of the parts of the standards depends on how the state has set up this process. On slide 30, the actual federal regulations are outlined there about what's required. And on slide 31, it's kind of goes over everything that the pieces of the water quality standards that are on the table when the triennial review is supposed to come up. The reality is that it's technically everything in the water quality standards, but the reality is that most states pick a few elements that have been identified as needing changes. Perhaps in the previous couple of years, they've been building a list of what's going to be addressed at the triennial review. It's most commonly a set of different criteria changes. But it can be the public involvement procedures. It can be the format of your water quality standards. And there should be some process for the citizens to identify concerns that can be addressed either in that triennial review or perhaps brought up in one triennial review and addressed in the next one. But there should be not just a chance for public response to what the state changes, but actually for public input. So involved and forceful in that process if you have changes you think are necessary. One quick example from the field, in New Mexico, we've worked with a group, Amigos Bravos, for years, and they do trainings around the state on the Clean Water Act, helping citizens understand, in particular, designated uses and what has been designated in their waters. And a couple of years ago, there were two cases where citizens identified waters that were used for swimming but had not been designated for swimming as part of these workshops. In fact, it was in the Rio Gallinas and a segment of the Rio Grande south of Albuquerque. Since the state was about to go into its triennial review, one of those changes was presented to the state agency, and they, in fact, the agency did include that change in its own proposal for changes during the triennial review. And the other change was presented at the triennial review, and they both have been adopted and added to the water quality standards. So in fact, if you do see changes, it's worth bringing them to the attention of the state agency, and it depends how your state works it, but it's very likely that it will get some attention at least. So with that, I'd like to pause and see if we have any questions at this point.
Yes, Gail, we are, as folks probably have guessed, we're on slide 33, which is our first question and answer period, and Gail had kind of mused out there whether or not people on the East Coast would be awake after lunch, and I can tell you that Rita in Michigan is definitely awake. She's been sending us a few questions. I'll ask one from Rita. Rita is confused, and those are her words. How does zero discharge and elimination of discharges fit in with NPDES?
Well, I can see the question that is posed there. The idea that we have, in fact, institutionalized the discharge of pollution, of pollutants to waters, rather than eliminated it, is a kind of a quandary for all of us. The intention, and that's why I like to bring up the actual language from the Act. How does zero discharge, in fact, and that goal by 1985, kind of jive with the picture that we see today? The intention was that the EPA and industry folks out there would, the research and development would progress in ways that would lead us to these permits ratcheting down what we're discharging into our public waters, and would eventually get to a point where we don't have to discharge. As we all know, that hasn't happened, and in fact, very little, if any, adjustments to the basic permits and the technology-based standards that were put in place originally have been updated and pushed in terms of what the best technology is out there. So it is an important question for citizens to keep raising, and I encourage folks to use the name of the NPDES program, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, in their comments when they do talk about permits, because in most cases you're not going to find that the discharge is on its way to being eliminated. But there is a disconnect between that goal and what we're seeing today, and it's I think up to citizens to keep pushing that point and hoping that we're going to get some technology changes that might lead us in that direction.
Thanks, Gail. Reminder to folks participating via simulcast, you can submit your questions by clicking the question mark button at the top of your screen. Now I'd like to open up the phone lines. I will unmute everyone at this time. And if you have a question, please identify yourself, and when acknowledged, we'll ask you for your question.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead, speaker.
This is Dave Markell calling from Tallahassee, Florida. I'm a law professor down here at Florida State University College of Law. What I was hoping to get out of this was ideally a list of the opportunities that citizens have to participate in various phases of the Clean Water Act process. I mean, do you know if, so two things. One is there a list of here are the eight stages of the Clean Water Act regulatory scheme that gives citizens a chance to participate, is question one, if there is such a list. And then question two is, any information you have about the extent to which the different mechanisms in the Clean Water Act for citizen involvement have been used and how effectively. So, I mean, I think this is a helpful kind of overview of the Clean Water Act so far. It's kind of what I do in part of my environmental law course when I teach it. So it's helpful, but what I was hoping to get out of this was kind of a comprehensive list of opportunities for citizens to participate in various phases of the Clean Water Act, and then also some sense of the experience in each of those phases to get a sense of how useful they've been.
Thanks for your question. I don't know off the top of my head of a list that you're describing, and in fact, in my experience, it seems that the opportunities vary depending upon how the programs have been set up state to state, in terms of when different states might allow for certain public involvement, say early on in a triennial review or early on in a development of an NPDES permit, versus others who only allow the public involvement piece to be part of the public comment. So I don't know that there's an overall list. There certainly are the specific places in the Act and in the regulations that say, and here's, you know, where public involvement is required. And I would point out just for reference whether or not this, I'm not sure you probably have this reference yourself given what you teach, but in Section 101E of the Clean Water Act is the public participation clause. It requires it in public participation in the development, revision, and enforcement of any regulation, standard, effluent limitation plan, or program. And it really sets it up, but then the devil is always in the details about when it's allowed and when it's been set up at the state level. So I'm sorry that I don't have something more like concrete or discreet, if you will. In terms of examples of what's been going on, some of what we do is because we work with folks all over the country, we do collect stories of where successes have been made, and I'm trying to offer some of those where the citizens have been able to make a difference in different parts of this, but I, you know, I just think it's such a large number of examples that, you know, I'd be happy to talk with you offline about some resources, different parts of the country, different law clinics and folks who are doing some of this work, but numbers of them.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Can I just follow up real quickly? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Just on the first part, I know EPA has authorized, you know, I don't know what the current number is, probably 45 or 47 states to run the NPDES permit program at this point. And, I mean, my guess is that as part of that authorization process, EPA evaluates the, you know, effectiveness of the citizen participation opportunities that the states are providing. I mean, it might be worth it for EPA to, I mean, if you guys, if this is especially important to you, I mean, you know, ELI has done a bunch of studies over the years about, you know, kind of different state programs and how they compare and how they compare to the federal model, et cetera. I mean, it might be worth it to compare, you know, compile.
Excuse me, this is the moderator. Caller, could you get to your question, please? We're going to need to get back on schedule.
Yeah, sure. So my question is, I guess I would urge EPA to consider developing a national database, checklist kind of document or electronically accessible set of information so that citizens can kind of understand in a quick and easy way what kinds of opportunities the feds require and then what kinds of opportunities, you know, exist in each state.
Okay, thank you very much, caller.
You're welcome.
Gail, in the interest of getting and staying on schedule, I would recommend that we continue with the presentation and maybe we could address some of these issues throughout your presentation. At this point, I will mute the phone lines, and Gail, I'll ask you to unmute yourself and continue your presentation.
Okay, I think I'm back here. Is that right?
You're there.
Thank you for that last question. I'm hoping the EPA folks take note of those kinds of things, seeing as I'm not one of them. So, so going on the next stage and keeping in our stepwise process here, we're on slide 34, starting with the water quality criteria part component of the water quality standards. I think if we're looking at going from slide 34 to 35, thinking back on what you wrote down when you were thinking about the uses, the water, the things that go on in your waters, the uses of your waters, I'd like you to now think about the characteristics of those waters that need to be in place to protect those uses. What are the protective levels of those characteristics? What needs to be monitored and how does it need to be monitored? Again, the states and tribes are responsible for identifying these characteristics and determining protective levels setting them into the water quality standards. So we're going to look at some examples of how the water quality criteria piece works, starting with slide 36. Started here with an example from California listing the list of the characteristics and the criteria that they've chosen for the Los Angeles River Basin. Determined that setting levels for these parameters and keeping track of them will protect the uses that have been previously designated. So you can see it's a long list here, and you can go on and on to look at how they've set these different criteria. If you go to slide 37, you are then looking at the specifics of these regional criteria on the LA River. You can see specifically how they've addressed the bacteria in the form of coliform And I'd like to point out that in paragraphs 2 through 4, you can see how these criteria, how what they, the numbers that they've put in here, are in fact tied directly to different particular uses. The second paragraph has water contact recreation, the third has non-water contact recreation, and the fourth has shellfish harvesting for human consumption. So important connection between the criteria that are developed and how they protect the uses. Slide 38 is an example from Alabama. In Alabama, you can see, again, the direct connection from at the top of the page. The swimming and other whole body water contact sports is the use that we're looking at, and then the specific criteria. Looking down the page and on to slide 39 as well, you can see that they've listed pH and temperature and bacteria and radioactivity and turbidity as important characteristics and parameters to pay attention to as we're trying to protect swimming and other whole body water contact sports. It's also interesting to note that the Alabama has chosen to put in a piece here about sewage needs to be controlled and the fact that the policy of non-degradation needs to be stringently applied, which we'll talk about in a little bit. You don't always see that in the categories underneath the uses as they've done. If you go to slide 40, there's another example of what we see for with regard to water quality criteria in Alabama, which is something, again, back to the category of applying to all waters, regardless of their uses. These are narrative criteria, and you'll notice that they describe what the water should be free from, shall be free from. A lot of times we hear this category, the free froms, and we'll see them in the state water quality criteria. Example, floating debris, oil, scum, and other floating materials is very common to see that, as well as free from toxics and toxic amounts. Slide 41 shows the similar statewide example for New Mexico. They've called it their general standards, and they've established them to sustain and protect existing or attainable uses of the surface waters, and generally applying to all surface waters unless otherwise specified. So looking in a different example, New Mexico has addressed bottom deposits and color and plant nutrients. Again, in essence, they're free from. If you look at slide 42, you can see how in New Mexico they've taken the combination of the criteria together with the uses and put them in basin-specific lists. This is the Jemez River all its tributaries listing. They've listed the designated uses, domestic water supply, fish culture, etc., and they've listed the important criteria under these uses to protect them are conductivity, pH, temperature, turbidity, and fecal coliform bacteria. So looking at how, again, the states have connected the criteria and the uses to paint the whole picture of what's protective here is an important component of our standards, and in this case the criteria component of it. On slide 43, there's another quiz before we go on. I'm not expecting answers. I want all of you to think about whether or not you know the answers to these questions. You can take a minute or two to think about these, and we'll hopefully come back to them.
And folks, while you're doing that, it appears that the muting system didn't work completely, so I'm going to re-mute everyone. And Gail, when you're ready to resume your presentation, please go ahead and unmute yourself.
I guess perhaps I'm unmuted now.
You're good.
On slide 44, we have the actual federal regulations for the water quality criteria, and this is, again, an important component as we work with these pieces of the standards. It's important to see what the states and tribes are required to pay attention to. States must adopt those water quality criteria that protect the designated use, that connection we've seen, based on sound scientific rationale, contain sufficient parameters to protect the designated uses and must support the most sensitive use. In fact, they must support all the uses, but are often driven by the most sensitive use, so it's important to make sure all uses are in fact protected. On slide 45, we talk a little bit more generically about what water quality criteria are. We've seen a little bit of this in the examples already. Numbers or and or words that describe conditions that are protective of the designated uses, and the protection of different characteristics. And again, this list, chemical, physical, biological, throws us back to the fundamental goal of the Clean Water Act, to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. So the criteria that are set are intended to address those components. Just thinking ahead about which criteria may fall into these categories, you can go to slide 46 and see some examples, and there are many others. Chemical criteria are metals and pesticides, and physical, temperature, sediment, and flow as well. Biological criteria or biocriteria are the index of biotic integrity. Biological conditions of a water body are compared to reference sites are set specifically in some states as numeric criteria, but often, if at all, are put in as narrative criteria in the biological conditions. So slide 47 talks, just introduces us, as we've seen already in the examples, numeric and narrative criteria are represent different parts of the picture. And in fact, they're both important to tell the whole story of what is needed for to protect the designated uses, because you can't set enough numbers to cover everything to protect waters. And the narrative act as a backstop, not really acting alone, but act as a backstop for the numbers and specific measurable benchmarks that you may not be able to set in ways that you want to say things like no toxic contaminants and toxic amounts. Going to slide 48, there's some examples of measurable benchmarks. We saw a few in the state examples there as well, whether it's dissolved oxygen or temperature or the index of biotic integrity. You hit the chemical, physical, biological examples there. They have components to the criteria that we'll talk about in a couple slides. Slide 49, we see, again, some other examples of the narrative criteria, the desirable conditions, free from floating debris, scum and oil, wastewater discharges will not be allowed to produce objectionable conditions such. We'll often see things in these narrative conditions, narrative criteria that say natural levels need to be, anything beyond natural levels will be prohibited. We saw that in the New Mexico example. And the waters must be free from, we're both in the Alabama and New Mexico examples. On slide 50, it just outlines a little bit about what criteria should address to protect, be fully protective of a designated use. How much of the pollutant is allowable for, how long is it allowable, and how often can the designated uses be exposed to these concentrations in order before there's a problem or before they aren't protected or supported. For example, on slide 48 a couple earlier, the dissolved oxygen criterion of greater than or equal to 5 milligrams per liter as a one-hour average, the how long, the time period of exposure, and not to be exceeded more than once per month. So encouraging your states to have all these components is a critical piece of protectiveness of the designated uses. On slide 51 is an example of where in the New Mexico standards there is the criteria are addressing the how often component. You can see acute standards shall not be exceeded, chronic standards shall not be exceeded more than once every 3 years. So trying to understand how and in what part, sometimes you won't get all the components, how much, how long, and how often, all in the same place in the water quality standards, and you need to look around to see how the state has addressed it, or ask them what that means, whether it's only can be violated once, never to be violated, or has some averaging component and over what amount of time. 552 emphasizes the connection of the uses to the criteria. Swimming and primary contact recreation, perhaps in almost all cases, hopefully every case, you'd see some kind of bacteriological component, a parameter that would be in place in the standards. And many states are moving to using E. coli, especially with the Beach Act. It's been required at the coastal areas. And the cold water aquatic life uses are often, you'll often see dissolved oxygen levels, temperature, perhaps turbidity, or total suspended solids as criteria that are set up to be protective of those designated uses. But the connection is important. So slide 53 goes back to the what you can do, and I can't emphasize enough about simply examining your water quality standards and looking at the criteria that have been set. Are the uses sufficiently protective of, are the uses sufficiently protected by the criteria, that is? Are the criteria as stringent as what EPA has set at a national level? If not, why not? Do they, in fact, protect any kinds of local species or local conditions that are perhaps not addressed at the federal level? Reviewing monitoring data can also help you understand whether or not the uses are fully protected by the criteria in place. If things are, criteria are being met, but uses are still in some way being affected, that means that the water quality criteria may not be stringent enough. Researching any kind of concerns, you're not expected to be an expert. Look to your state agency, look to universities in the area, look to private consultants that might be able to help you. They might have their own data to add to your concerns or the information you're pulling together. And again, coming back to the triennial review or the opportunity to petition for changes in between triennial reviews, it really is important to bring your concerns to the table and emphasize to your state that there needs to be an opportunity for public involvement in these kinds of changes. A state example, a story I'd like to just emphasize on slide 54 is that in Tennessee, a couple years ago, there was a proposed weakening of the dissolved oxygen and the pH criteria in certain water bodies due to what the state called natural conditions. And a coalition of environmental groups claimed that the weaker criteria would not, in fact, support aquatic life uses. This coalition claimed that the proposed change was more directed toward allowing nearby wastewater treatment plants to increase the discharges, that they were trying to increase these discharges to meet their increased development pressures, and that also these changes were associated with reducing the responsibilities of coal mining operations to address pH changes that might be happening downstream of their tailings. The coalition commented on the proposed changes and alerted EPA to the problems, raised significant public concern, and in fact, when the standards were reviewed by EPA, EPA did not approve these two changes, and the state has decided to keep the criteria in place. So that, another example of involvement at the public level, raising your concerns, telling the right people, getting the data on the table, and trying to make the public process work is a lot of this is the onus. While the opportunities should be available, the onus is often on the public to get their comments in the door to the agency at the appropriate time. So don't hesitate to ask questions about when those times are and how to broaden them if possible. Slides 55 and 56 are a little bit more detailed because the triennial review is relevant to not only uses but to criteria. Coming back to this issue is that every state does it differently. So contacting your agency is definitely the first way to find out how to participate, find out the timing, when's the next one happening, what the process is, how does the public get involved. Put your comments, your concerns in a comment letter right away. to let them know that you have concerns on the table. So if there is already an internal process of developing certain changes for the training review going on inside the agency, that they know that there's public concerns out there, find out what the formal process is, and perhaps see if it's broader than just reviewing what the agency is bringing to the table at the end. If your state, and this is the case on slide 56, in many states, the state or tribe has not had the triennial review in more than 3 years, it's important to encourage this process to happen more frequently. And in fact, the state of Wisconsin has never had a triennial review, and so we have examples of states that call it a rolling process and not really every 3 years, but make changes as needed and take in comments. And whether or not, again, it's an appropriate or useful public process really has to do with how the state has set it up. So it's really important to make your concerns known and find out what the current state process is. So with that, we can open up for a couple more questions on the criteria component.
Great. Thanks, Gail. We are now on slide number 57. It's time for our second question and answer period. We'll start with questions that were submitted online. We're hearing from California. Lisa in California wants to know, does a delisting of a 303D stream require a use attainability analysis, or a UAA?
That's actually a good connection of a bunch of different topics. The delisting, we are seeing states themselves or entities coming to states wanting to go through a use attainability analysis in order to change a designated use or weaken a designated use in order to get it off the 303D list, the list of impaired and threatened waters. And there's a lot of pressures, and the list of impaired and threatened waters is one of them that is kind of bringing people to this use attainability analysis process. So, in fact, the UAA, the use attainability analysis, is required to change the designated use, which in fact then may, if it is weakened, may then result in the water body that use is changed for may then come off the list because it's no longer, if it's weaker, it's the current conditions may no longer violate that use or may no longer have problems supporting a weaker use. So it's not that the UAA is required for the delisting. The UAA is required to remove or change the designated use, and then that in turn means that it's no longer impaired or threatened. So it's kind of a two-part process. We are seeing that those two things happening in tandem in order for states to reduce the size of their 303D list and in order for them to have fewer responsibilities or demands on their time for developing the subsequent total maximum daily loads or the watershed restoration plan. So it's definitely something to look out for, but that process is in place to remove or change the use, and then not necessarily to pull it off the list. That would be a subsequent step.
Thanks, Gail. I'll now go ahead and unmute the phone lines. And are there any questions from the phone world? Any questions?
Actually, I have a question. I'm the 319 coordinator in Region 2. My name is Donna. And there's been, you know, I went to several meetings in recent months, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, water quality standards and, you know, trying to get the most bang for the buck and, you know, through the 319 program. And it seems to me that when you're, you know, and we're on the path to removing water bodies from the 303D list, and it just appears to me that as you try to get closer to achieving that, the cost is phenomenal, like, say, nitrogen removal. And so the concept to me, it seems, of getting the most bang for your buck is really disappearing, because it's impossible at that point when you're trying to get the last 10, 20%, you know, removal in order to get it from the 303G list. And it concerns me because we don't get credit for anything unless they remove from the list. And so I'm just bringing that up to get your opinion and see, you know, how do you feel about what I said.
I guess I'm not sure about a specific response.
Well, basically, I'm trying to say is that, you know, you if you're focusing on reducing, say, nitrogen loads, and you manage to get 60% of the load, and you still have 40%, or 70% of the load, and you still have 30%, it's that last, you know, 30% where the cost can be astronomical to implement projects and things. And so I'm looking at this in a different way, and I'm wondering, you know, like I said, the concept of getting the most bang for your buck at that point is really, you can't do it because it's just so expensive to remove that remaining part. And I wanted just your opinion on that. Do you agree?
Well, I'm sure that you and others on the line are probably even perhaps more versed in some of the nuances of playing with that last 40%, in particular in the non-point source world. I know there's a lot of EPA work going on with regard to the pollution trading concept, and I think there are some who are cautious about how that moves forward, but where there are opportunities to not have hot spots develop or third-party impacts that could allow for some of those costs to be picked up in a regulatory sense, there's opportunities there. And I think that question about how we get to the end result is an implementation question that we all are, it's commensurate on all of us to kind of be involved in that process. And the work that I focus on mostly is to help people understand where the law starts and ends, and in fact, without changes to the law itself and the regulations, there still are requirements to leave things on the list and work with it that way.
Thanks, Gail. I'm sorry, we'll have to get back on schedule. We are still running a little bit behind time, but I do promise you that we'll have time for questions a little bit later in the presentation. At this time, I will mute the phone lines. Ask Gail to resume her presentation starting on slide 58.
Okay, I think I'm back on here. So where we go now is to our third component. And the third component of the water quality standards is the anti-degradation policy. Many folks aren't as familiar with this component of the water quality standards. It seems that the uses and criteria pieces are much more familiar to the general public, if you will, and this idea of where anti-degradation comes into play, and the fact that every state and tribes who have the water quality program have to develop this policy consistent with federal regulations, comes in a little bit of a surprise to some. So looking at slide 59, we really tie back to the original Clean Water Act goal to understand and to emphasize the restore and maintain, the maintain part of the goal. The fact that a lot of our attention, whether it be from the listing process of impaired waters and the development of cleanup plans or TMDLs, that's really been focused on the restore component and a lot of what, before the 1972 Act, a lot of what the attention was paid to. But this idea of maintaining the quality that we do have and trying to hold the line wherever possible is a powerful concept. Going to slide 60, we can see that it's kind of it's been around for a long time. The idea even predates as policy predates the Clean Water Act, and yet folks are less familiar with it, at least. Excuse me. The federal policy regulation was put into place at 40 CFR section 131.12, and it wasn't in the Clean Water Act originally, but it was added to the Clean Water Act later on. It is a component of every state's water quality standards, as we've got listed there, and the state policy must be consistent with the federal regulations. The state has to have a policy and implementation procedures in place in order for the water quality standards to be adequate. And that's an important concept that a lot of folks have been paying some attention to lately. To get to the importance of this a little bit, I use a diagram here. Starting on page 61, one important way to look at it is the continuum of our waters in a very simplistic way, obviously, that there are some that are really sick and some that are really healthy, and there's obviously a continuum in between that where there's some sickness and a lot of health or a little health and a lot of sickness. So for a long time, even after the Clean Water Act was passed, attention was only paid to the sickest and the healthiest of waters along this continuum. Going to slide 62, since the mid-1990s, the attention has significantly increased on waters that have problems, and in particular where it was moved forward that every state ended up with a full submission for the TMDL, for the 303D list, that is, and a lot of attention toward getting the states to take that list and start developing the TMDLs from it. That attention to the side of the problems and what we do with those problems and how we improve them has really gotten a lot of attention and money, and some would say too much perhaps, but it is the case. As we move to slide 63, it is the case that, in particular, a lot of the tools and a lot of what people know has to do with addressing more and more of the problems, the sicknesses, if you will, that we see in this continuum. But what does that mean for the pressure on the healthier waters? If you go to slide 64, and I pretend that I'm someone who wants to discharge something into the waters, or I have an activity that I want to develop an area in waters, or along a basin I'd like to put a new development in. Where am I going to want to go where there's a lot more attention being paid in these waters where there are problems and there's specific requirements about what I don't do in these waters and everybody's paying attention to those waters? Or am I going to go to the waters that are healthier and potentially act in those waters because there's more dilution, the waters can quote-unquote handle it? I think I'm going to get less attention and perhaps less requirements if I go towards these healthier waters. And without adequate anti-degradation protections, this thinking and this situation can result in all of our waters ending up with problems or significant pressure on those waters that are in good shape, and when we're not dealing with it ahead of time, that we end up, that all the waters end up having problems and we have to fix them in some way. But if we move to slide 65, a more balanced way to look at it is to bring in the protections for the healthier waters, and that being the adequate implementation of the anti-degradation policies across the board, is trying to take into account where not only where waters are healthy, but where there's a little bit of health still and there may be some problems, and how we protect the health as well as trying to clean up the problems. So that overlap is a critical part of this process, to try to maintain and restore and maintain, as the goal of the Act says. If we go to slide 66, the basics of the policy, kind of to keep the healthy waters healthy, really rests on three levels of protection. There's the protection for existing uses that we've already been talking about to some degree, the protection for high-quality waters. High-quality waters are those that are in better shape than, they're doing better than necessary to support uses that are designated. They're doing better than criteria that have been designated would necessarily say they need to be. So they're doing better than the standards, the minimum standards that are set to protect uses are in the water quality standards. And outstanding waters are also protected, and those waters are those of exceptional recreational or ecological significance. Whether or not their existing water quality is pristine, it can be the exceptional recreational or ecological significance that drives this outstanding quality. And it's important to point out that anti-degradation review is really about looking at things that are proposed in waters. So a review to prevent the harm to these characteristics. Some examples of when this would be necessary, looking on slide 67, when an anti-degradation review should be triggered, there's a list there, and focusing on perhaps the most obvious, a discharge permit issuance, an NPDES permit issuance, and what might the process be. So the importance is for the anti-degradation review is required to evaluate whether, if this discharge is to occur, are existing uses to be harmed, and in particular NPDES discharges that are new and or expanded. And so it's this idea of something else is going to be done in the waters or discharged to the waters that we have to pay attention to, and the potential that it will result in degradation. So will the existing uses be harmed? If so, the permit needs to be changed so that it's not or not permitted. And jumping to the other piece, whether or not any outstanding, water quality of outstanding waters would be in some way not maintained or not protected. So looking at those two pieces, they're more absolutes. The second component of high quality waters is more of a process. If in fact the high quality water characteristics may be degraded, if there are qualities that exceed what is necessary for uses to be supported and they're doing better than the criteria state in the water quality standards, the state actually must find that this activity that might degrade these waters is necessary. In other words, have alternatives been fully evaluated to see that this activity is necessary and that it also is socially and economically justified in the local area? Even if after those findings by the state that this activity is going to be allowed in order to minimize what the degradation is in those high quality waters, again, to get back to this goal of maintaining the quality we do have, any activity that is going to happen must have the most stringent statutory and regulatory controls in place for point sources and all cost-effective and reasonable best management practices for non-point sources in place. And the bottom line is, even if something is allowed to be degraded a little bit, still no harm can come to existing uses. So it's not a linear process. There needs to be the attention to the existing uses, the attention to high quality waters, and a process for minimizing any reduction in that quality, and then also the maintenance and protection of quality of outstanding waters. So that's kind of the summary of where we go with anti-degradation, which sometimes can take several hours or a day to discuss. But on slide 68, there's a few things that you can do to understand more about how your state applies anti-degradation. Looking actually at the policy and implementation procedures that are in the water quality standards is the first step, and trying to figure out how the permit review process occurs and whether or not there is an anti-degradation review that currently happens. Is it publicly available? Is important to find out. Examining the activities that have potential to harm existing uses or degrade water quality or impact outstanding waters, and commenting on those activities or letting the state agency know they're occurring if there isn't a permit process, trying to figure out how to minimize what is going on in these waters that have anti-degradation protection, if you will. Insisting on anti-degradation review where it's appropriate, that it's documented with a public process, challenging permits that have not had adequate anti-degradation review, and again, this component fits into the triennial review process if there's concerns that the policy is not consistent with the federal regulations, and that there aren't, for example, many states don't have implementation procedures outlined in their regulations, how that can be rectified through either the triennial review or a petition process. So on slide 69, I just wanted to relay a couple examples of how anti-degradation has happened over the last few years, some anti-degradation improvements have happened in the field. Through a number of permit challenges, MPDS permit challenges, discharge permit challenges in the field, in Illinois, and attempts to try to get the state agency to pay attention to the need for an formal anti-degradation review, that review improved and the regulatory changes actually went through the state agency, and in the Illinois case had to go through the legislature as well. And that was a few years ago, so there's been improvement in Illinois. In Tennessee, there was a permit challenge in the town of Spencer, and it was a successful challenge to a discharge that would have gone into a pristine cave system. And from that permit challenge, the state was alerted to some changes that needed to happen at the state level, and there were regulatory changes to their policy and implementation procedures. In Georgia, there was a permit challenge that was successful in terms of keeping additional pollution from a water body in Gwinnett County, but regulatory changes have been put in place. In fact, the legislature has made some changes that may roll back some of that success. In New Mexico, there was a new process for designating the outstanding waters that was developed a couple years ago, and now there has since been, and that was done by a citizen group, the Amigos Bravos folks, developing that procedure for outstanding water designation, and then the first couple designations have been since put in place in the last 2 years. So those are ways that citizens have been involved with improvements and identification of concerns and challenges at the state level in anti-degradation. Again, there's a lot of details that can't be covered in such a short time, but you can find additional resources in our owner's manual and on our online course, and I'm available afterwards. But I can open up now on slide 70 for some more questions if we want.
Great. Thanks, Gail. See, everybody, I did promise we'd have time for questions. We'll go online first, and we've got one from Rachel in North Carolina, who is kind of pointing out the fact that there are a lot of environmentally friendly or conscientious citizens out there who just don't get their relationship to the Clean Water Act, how clean water affects them, or how the Clean Water Act has to do with them, or how their everyday actions can impact clean water. And Rachel mentions that direct ties to health and pocketbook need to be better illustrated. Gail, do you have any examples of how this has been done successfully or resources that people can refer to?
Well, it's a very important point, and the public health component, whether it's there's a lot of attention lately on drinking water, in particular source water protection, to really tie that into Clean Water Act activities. I guess the example I gave in New Mexico about citizens coming forward because they were in fact swimming in waters that were not designated for swimming as a designated use is an example of concern about public health, because if the designation for swimming is not there, then the protections are also not there. And what these citizen groups realized is that the activities that are allowed, whether it be a discharge or some other activities in the water body that have to comply with water quality standards, if there isn't an attention to, hey, there's folks swimming here, we need to worry about bacterial contamination or other kinds of concerns for the public that will be submerged in this water, then there are activities that will be allowed that may, in fact, harm those kind of uses. So the work in New Mexico where the groups came forward and were able to be convincing about protecting their waters for swimming is an example of that public health component. The drinking water connection is a huge one, and off the top of my head I would say the group Clean Water Action, Clean Water Fund, has done probably the most that I can think of in terms of making this Clean Water Act, Drinking Water Act link apparent in some of their work. If I think of some other specific examples of the pocketbook side of things, I'll mention it before the end, because that's critical and actually plays in a few of these cases of the Clean Water Act tools as well, but I'll think a little bit about that.
We have another question submitted out of California, kind of a pertinent question for a state that's seeing a lot of rainfall these days. Lisa wants to know, how does the Clean Water Act, address the impact of water quantity to water quality, specifically the adverse impact of increased or decreased flows?
That's a wonderful, nice long question that I could spend a lot of my time on. I'd like to point out ways that, and this is from a river network perspective, that there are many opportunities to tie in water quantity elements in our Clean Water Act advocacy. I will put out the caveat that I'm imagining that our EPA folks would have perhaps some other responses, so I'll just put this out there. When you're looking at water quality standards, in particular aquatic habitat protections that relate back to stream flow levels and scouring versus healthy ecosystem kinds of settings. In a lot of states, you'll have an aquatic life narrative criterion that says something about healthy riparian areas or biological community. Those connections all have a flow component to them and sometimes can come into play when you're trying to deal with some of the water quality issues. There's some case law out there that make very strong connections between Clean Water Act, the importance of the Clean Water Act paying attention to flows. Jefferson County Public Utility District up in Washington State was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that did that. And it is important that we pay attention to water quantity when you're looking at the dilution of what's coming out of a discharge permit, when you're looking at the critical conditions for a TMDL, when a plan for a watershed is being established. You have to understand what the water regime is in terms of how the different allocations of those pollutants are going to play out over time, and it's not just an average. It needs to be seasonal fluctuations in the critical conditions. So there's just so many ways that it plays into the picture, and in particularly in the West, where we have the Western water law issues, it's important to point out that there is an enormous caveat in the front of the Clean Water Act, Section 101G, that does say that it's the policy of Congress that the authority of each state to allocate quantities of water within its jurisdiction shall not be superseded, abrogated, or otherwise impaired by this act. So there's this balance between the state's rights on allocation of water quantity and ways that the stream flow, stormwater flows, and variation of withdrawals, that hydrologic modification, if you will, that really plays into every one of the Clean Water Act tools.
Okay, thanks, Gail. I'm going to go ahead and unmute the phone lines. Do we have any questions from our phone participants?
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
In a situation where you're dealing with a water body that has been declared impaired, but TMDLs have not been established for it yet, and the main problem is non-point source. Every development that occurs puts more non-point source into the river, pollution, both nutrients and everything else. Is there a hook to be able to make people accountable for that?
It's a really good question, and there may be actually a component that you're dealing with that you may not realize is a point source, but it may be so because of depending upon where you live, the stormwater regulations that have been put in place recently, in particular for construction, construction stormwater requirements dictate what goes on on every development, for example, and that's over 1 acre. So, or anything that's smaller than 1 acre but larger, part of a larger common plan. So if you're in fact this water body that's being subject to all these new discharges, from, say, new construction activity, they are point sources and should be included in the calculations for a TMDL and should be, in fact, be included in the not cause or contributing to the problems that you've got with the impaired waters. If it is, say, impaired for sediment, and you've got more sediment or other kinds of pollutants coming in with the sediment that may be worsening that problem. So you may actually have a point source there that that you haven't tied into. There's a lot of hesitancy on the part of the states and the entities that are getting those construction permits to really tie it back into the listing and the impaired waters issues and the TMDL process. So I would encourage you maybe to look into that.
Okay, because that would be a good thing to look into. But right now, as we understand it, if they are so-called meeting the standards that have been set by the state for sediment and erosion control, there is nothing that says that they are for the polluting. I mean, presumably you'd have to prove it.
Right. The challenges certainly do come into play when it's a performance-based, you know, or best management practice-based permit, which says if you do this, then you're complying. I'll just put out there that there are folks around the country who are trying to get at this challenge, and feel free to email me, and I'll try to connect you with some of them.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Going to mute the phones again, and we'll resume our presentation on slide 71.
Okay, I think I'm back. So starting on slide 71, what I want to do here for our remaining time is just making some of these connections to these tools, which have come up a little bit in our question and answer here as well. My large caveat is that this topic is about how the water quality standards fit into all these tools is big. Each one of these could be another hour discussion. So I really am just cruising over the top here to try to give people ideas, and feel free to contact me later, and I'm sure I'll hear lots of different sides of this. But the areas that I hope to address in our remaining minutes here is where the application of the water quality standards, where really the rubber hits the road. The standards don't enforce themselves. They're employed in the tools of the Clean Water Act. So that's why this is an important part, how they play into all of that. And we'll try to cover a little bit on the threatened and impaired waters list, total maximum daily loads, discharge permits, state water quality certification, and non-point source control, very briefly. So on slide 72, starting with the threatened and impaired waters list, perhaps maybe the most obvious of all these tools that directly relates back to the importance of the water quality standards and getting them right is the 303D list that I'll refer to it, as many of you probably already know, is a section of the Clean Water Act that calls for this list of impaired and threatened waters to be developed every 2 years, and so that's why it's called that. If the criteria, if the water quality criteria of this list in a given state are weak, is the list likely to be shorter or longer? And that's the basic question. If the uses and criteria aren't stringent, most likely the list of waters is shorter because fewer of the things going on in the water bodies, fewer of the water bodies are violating weaker standards. So therefore, if we have a state that has more stringent criteria, the list is likely to be longer. And it gets back to the person's question about taking waters off the list and whether or not that involves the use attainability analysis process. And we really do see states trying to downgrade or weaken their uses in order to, downgrade or weaken the uses, which in effect will shorten their list and end up with fewer requirements for TMDLs to be developed. So this is a little bit of detail about what the list is. In fact, the list then, in turn, there's a lot of circularity of all these tools, needs to be considered when issuing discharge permits, because the permits are not allowed to cause or contribute to this impairment, and also in the process of the 401 certification, which we'll get to in a little bit. So getting on the mailing list for 303D list and submitting information you might have about this list, paying attention to when waters are, the uses are changed and how that affects the list is important. Going to slide 73, excuse me, we start to build our diagram out a little bit. We had the goals, and the goals feed into the water quality standards and the discharge permit process, at least ideally. Water quality standards are going to feed into permits. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But water quality standards really do feed into whether or not waters are impaired or threatened. And then the threatened and impaired waters list feeds back into what is allowed to be discharged into our waters. Slide 74, getting into the what happens after the list is developed part of it. Probably most of you know about the total maximum daily load program. These TMDLs, if you will, refer to kind of two different things, that either both the calculation of what is the safe amount of a pollutant. Safe amount is kind of perhaps an oxymoron there, but the amount of a pollutant that a water body can handle, again, in quotations. And it's also, the total maximum daily loads term has also been used as a broader term for the whole plan for what are we going to do to fix this problem that has been identified in the 303D list. So the obvious ways that the water quality standards come into play is that if it's resulted, the standards are a certain stringency resulting in the waters being on the impaired and threatened waters list, it then needs to be put into the TMDL program and prioritized for a TMDL, a cleanup plan, if you will, a restoration plan. What's really critical in the development of the TMDL is that the water quality standards in the water body or in the segments or water body that is for which the TMDL is being developed that those standards are being used as the goal for the plan, for the calculation. The question of how much pollution the water body can handle has to do with what the water quality standard is, what needs to be the conditions in order to support the uses that are currently not being supported. So, again, the water quality standards play an important role in how the TMDL gets developed. And, again, the TMDL comes back after being developed as it needs to play into the adjustments to MPDS permits, as well as factored into any new MPDS permits that are drafted and issued. In the steps that are recommended in a total maximum daily load that aren't specifically required but are recommended, and most states are doing these steps as well, monitoring the progress on the TMDL involves the water quality standards. There's no question that monitoring how close over time benchmarks are put in place, if you're lucky, to monitor against those benchmarks and then call for revision of the TMDL if it's not actually getting there over a certain period of time. So if we go to slide 76, you tie in the restoration plans of the TMDLs coming out of the threatened and impaired waters. From those restoration plans, permits need to be adjusted to reflect what the allocations are in that restoration plan. And then there hopefully is some monitoring and revision associated with after those adjustments to permits and activities that determines whether the waters are still sick and they need to go back to a revision to the TMDL, or if the waters are in fact healthy and kind of loop back to meeting the goals of the Act. There should be also an arrow there going directly from restoration plans to the discharge permits, because they really also play into the not just the adjustments to existing permits, but the new permits that may be issued. So on slide 75, looking at the discharge permit program itself, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, we've kind of made certain reference to technology-based limits that are in place. Those are industry-wide, given all the secondary wastewater treatment plants have the same technology-based effluent limits, same category they're developed. But then if there are problems, if there's certain conditions in the receiving water body that require it, water quality-based limits must be added. And so that's where specifically development of the limits in a discharge permit needs to pay attention to the water quality standards and the conditions in the water body that may be receiving this discharge. The permit writers are supposed to be performing something called a reasonable potential analysis to determine the reasonable potential for any violation of water quality standards in the case of this discharge, and that would lead to any potential violation should lead to water quality based effluent limits and additions to the limits that might be the basic technology based ones. As I mentioned a minute ago, when there are impaired waters, that's supposed to play into the discharge process, and those obviously have been identified through evaluation with water quality standards, because the regulations say you can't cause or contribute to these impairments or threats that are already out there. And when TMDLs are set, the MPDS permits have to play into the allocations that are set up that are going to hopefully lead to the restoration of the water body or series of water bodies that are pulled together in the TMDL. So that's the discharge permit connection, if you will, very quickly. And then slide 77 talks about the state water quality certification, which is a privilege. States are allowed to review federal activities to see if they actually meet water quality standards. That's an obvious connection to the standards. And there's some examples of when that happens. And the states are allowed to certify the activity or certify it with conditions or deny it if it's not going to meet the water quality standards. The stringency and the success, how good the water quality standards are obviously play into this process. The states can, in fact, waive that privilege and it automatically happens if they don't certify within a year. On slide 78, the non-point source program also comes into play here because the water quality standards are instrumental in identifying where there are non-point sources of pollution, where there are problems that are not addressed simply by the regulatory schemes that are set up. And implementing the grant program and focusing the dollars in places where water quality standards need to be met, and the recent emphasis on development of and focus on 319 monies, grant monies that go toward the TMDL process leads back to the water quality standards goals that we know about. So on slide 79, I just kind of bring the so what together. There's so many different things that you can do with this and beyond, way beyond what I've been able to cover here. But it's just critical to understand that the water quality standards play such a fundamental role in all of these pieces, and that the Act itself has the components of public pressure, asking questions, opening the door for the citizens to get in and be part of the successful implementation and achievement of the restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. We're seeing increasing ways with state agency budget cuts, and particularly on the inspection and enforcement side of programs, that the citizen roles are absolutely critical, and that so many of these programs have become complaint-driven. So you really need to understand that your role is important. And I'd like to ultimately thank you for your time today. There's so much more we could cover. I encourage you to look at the resources, the Clean Water Act Owner's Manual and the online course are the beginnings, and I really would welcome email messages and of all sorts that people want to debate about topics. There's lots of debate that's out there. As I said at the beginning, River Network works with groups individually, gives trainings, and helps others become trainers, and our River Rally is our big event for the training. If you want to know more about us, go to our website, rivernetwork.org, and we welcome the chance to work more with any of you on this. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks, Gail. And as folks may notice, we will be on slide 80, which is our final question and answer period. We do have a few minutes to answer additional questions. However, I would first like to again draw everyone's attention to where you can obtain Gail's contact information. If you're online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. From there, you'll be returned to the home page, which has Gail's email address and phone number. And she has invited you, so take advantage. At the bottom of the home page, you will find two additional items. One is the link to additional resources, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's session. Clicking this link will direct you to several useful resources, including the Clean Water Act Owner's Manual and River Network's Clean Water Act online course. In addition, we have EPA's Introduction to the Clean Water Act and EPA's Water Quality Standards websites hot linked, just to name a few. The second item at the bottom of the homepage is the seminar feedback form. Please do consider completing this form as we do keep an eye on your comments while improving our webcasts. Now, we do have additional time for people to ask questions on the phone. We'll start with online first. And while we're asking questions, I do encourage people to move the slide forward to slide 81. There we have some additional resources, including Gail's phone number and email address. Gail, we've got two separate emails out of New Mexico, one of clarification question, and this comes from Beth. In slides 48 and 52, you gave examples of criteria that should not be exceeded, and dissolved oxygen was one of those. And the slide suggests that the criterion of greater than or equal to 5 milligrams per liter should not be exceeded in slide 48. And in slide 52, where you're talking about cold water, the criterion is greater than or equal to 6 milligrams per liter. And the question that Beth has is, I thought dissolved oxygen was a good thing. Could you maybe clarify about what is meant by exceedance level?
Thank you, Beth, for pointing that out. I said that the wrong way. You're absolutely right. Dissolved oxygen we want more of. So what should be there is more like should not be violated. It should not be below that amount. So that you're absolutely right that that was kind of the wrong wording to use in that example. We ran it that same way with the index of biotic integrity because we want more of that as well. So I apologize for putting that on the wrong way and making it confusing.
We all err. out of New Mexico, Nolene wants to know, Gail, in your opinion, what has been the overall effect on water pollution of states taking over NPDES from the U.S. EPA?
Well, I know that's a trick question because New Mexico is currently evaluating whether or not to explore this option. And I know there's a lot of nuances and issues associated with this issue. As an earlier questioner pointed out, the majority of the states have in fact taken over the running of the NPDES program, and there's a lot of, I think it depends on how the state runs the program as to whether or not it would end up being a positive or less than positive comparison with the current situation for citizens. One of the things that's gained is, especially in the case of New Mexico, perhaps more local connection to the people writing the permits rather than folks in Dallas, which is where EPA is doing it currently for New Mexico. Some of the things that are lost are some of the connections to the federal review process, whether it's for the National Environmental Policy Act review or it's for the 401 certification that we talked about, how that process works, that would be removed because it would no longer be a federal permit. There's some concerns about loss of the Endangered Species Act connection as well. So there's definitely pros and cons to be weighed, and there have to be a lot of reasons that most of the states have taken it over. And there have been successes and challenges in all states. So it's not one size fits all, because I think the different situations have arisen for different states. So I can connect Nolene with some other folks in New Mexico who have really dived into this issue for the state, if she's not already connected with them, which I imagine she is.
Great. And now I am unmuting the phones for the last word. Does anybody out on the phone line have any questions for Gail? Anyone at all? Okay. At this time, I would like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Gail for presenting today, and of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. Please visit EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum at www.epa.gov/watershedforum to discuss more issues related to this topic. We also encourage folks to return to the registration homepage, www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast, for notice about upcoming webcasts sponsored by the Watershed Academy. Our next webcast will be May 17th. In celebration of American Wetlands Month, Tom Schuler of the Center for Watershed Protection will give a presentation tentatively entitled Integrating Wetlands in Watershed Protection Efforts. Tom will describe ways that local communities can integrate wetlands into larger watershed protection projects. He will also present new tools to help protect these valuable aquatic resources. So please mark your calendars for this sure-to-be-intriguing webcast, May 17th. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you very much.